different and interesting topics. Excuse my voice because I am a little bit sick, got a kind of flu. And the first two speakers are coming from Kocaeli University, from the Faculty of Art and Sciences, Department of Western Languages and Literatures. And Turgay Daryavuz is a third year student, and Derya Diner is the fourth year student. This session will be focusing on the mythos and mythology as a concept, and their papers will focus on this topic. They will present dream limits in storytelling and try to explain how ancient people described mythological gods in their mythological stories. The floor is yours.
Thank you. My name is Reyes.
The ancient Greeks used concretization technique to describe their deities. In this presentation, I'm going to talk about how their dream were limited by their description techniques. While they described deities, they focused on nature and environment. They tried to materialize many things in order to describe or answer things beyond their understanding. In order to define mysterious events, ancient people utilized form, objects and living organisms, which were available around them. So, they improved themselves in many areas, such as art, science, theater, and philosophy, etc. In a way, they benefited from earthly things as they created or composed stories. I think that this situation led to limit their dream world. Their using of concretization technique restricts their way of representation of reality. Before I'll give some examples about our idea, I will mention what the storytelling is, secondly, where it comes from, and then what the importance of storytelling in ancient Greece. Stories are source of all cultures, defining our values, desires, dreams, and as well as our prejudices and enmities. The beginning of the storytelling dates back to ancient times. We can say that oral stories, which passed down from generation to generation, are the beginning of narration or storytelling. It's a tool for conveying cultures. Nobody knows when the first story was actually told, but it is believed that stories were used long time ago to calm fears or doubts of people. In a way, storytelling is an answer to mysterious events. When people began to live in tribes, they created a common culture. Storytelling was one of the most important activities which brought people together. Mostly priests, judges, or rulers of the tribes used this art effectively in the history of storytelling. If people want to learn something, they need to be good listeners and have a good memory, because at that time, writing hadn't been invented yet. That's why a good storyteller, bard, was always respected. The stories which the storytellers told were also shared with others in faraway lands. When they traveled, the stories traveled with them. When they came back, they brought new cultures from other places, and also they extended their stories. Storytelling became a connection between cultures, such as myths, legends, etc., passed from generation to generation. They are told and retold until present. Stories reflect wisdom and knowledge of ancient people. In ancient times, people used storytelling not only past knowledge, but also understand the confused events. There are some stories which used in order to describe unexplainable events like natural disasters. People used storytelling to explain these events, and that's why they created gods and myths. At that time, there was a question which we still have. How are we created, or who created us? In Greek mythology, they believed that Prometheus, who is son of a Titan, created human with his own tears, and then he steal fire from Hephaestus' oven and give it to human. When Zeus learned the situation, he got angry with him and punished him by chaining to a rock. Then he ordered Hephaestus to create the first woman with a box in order to punish Prometheus' creatures, as in our Pandora's box. So, human being was created. This was one of the stories in which aim is to explain events which are beyond human's reality. Understandably, ancient people created their myths with the limits of their perception. As you see in the picture, they portrayed Prometheus as a man. It's exactly like human with his muscles, hairs, etc. They didn't create something new. They just imitate what they saw in their lives. There is another myth in order to explain how mankind created. According to it, wisers decided to put an end to Bronze Age, which is one of the five ages of mankind. Deucalion, by the advice of Prometheus, constructed a chest. Having it stored with provisions, he embarked in it with Fira. But Zeus, by pouring heavy rain from heaven, flooded the greater part of Greece, so that all men were destroyed. But Deucalion, floating in the chest over the sea for 9 days as many nights, drifted to Parnassus, and there, when the rain ceased, he landed and sacrificed to Zeus, the god of escape. And Zeus sent Hermes to him and allowed him to choose what he would. And he chose to get mad. At the bidding of Zeus, he took up stones and threw them over his head. And the stones Deucalion threw became man. And the stones Fira threw became woman. They answered their questions about creation with these myths. In the myth, they didn't use stone as something holy or beyond their reality. Also, while Zeus banished humanity, he used flood rather than something beyond their reality. As you see, ancient people created their myths by what they saw from environment. From these stories, I want to ask you a question. Can you imagine something that you have never seen? Until now, I gave you some information about storytelling, where it was created, and how ancient people used it. Now, my friend Daria will show some examples to support our idea.
Now, I will show some examples to support my idea. In the ancient period, people tend to use concretization technique in their stories, while their gods and goddesses look like human mythological creatures resemble animals. Firstly, I will touch upon description of the Greek gods and goddesses, then the similarities between deities and human beings. Secondly, I will compare the similarities of animals and mythological creatures. And finally, I will analyze a love story which is about Zeus' love to Europa. In ancient Greece, people had a polytheistic religion. That's why there were lots of gods and goddesses. The important ones are known as the 12 great Olympians. Zeus is mostly depicted as the supreme ruler of the gods, lord of the sky, and rain god, the cloud gatherer who wielded the awful thunderbolts. When we focus on his physical appearances, he has a beard, curly hair, huge muscles. He is generally depicted as a mature man because he is considered as the god of gods. One of the goddesses of the 12 Olympians, Athena, was daughter of Zeus alone. According to myths, no mother bore her, full grown and full in armor, she sprung from Zeus' head. In the Iliad, she is fierce and ruthless battle goddess, the protector of the civil's life, handicrafts and the agriculture. She is a tall, slim woman and with blush, green eyes, tricking light, wearing a suit of armor and a golden helmet. In order to describe similarities between gods and human beings, I use these two examples. As we see in the picture, similarities between gods and mankind are so obvious. Both of them look exactly like human figures, including these two gods. All 12 Olympian deities have the same physical appearances. The only differences between ancient Greek gods and mankind are that deities are depicted as mighty, huge, powerful, briefly exaggerated forms of human attributes. This proves that earthly things limit the way of human understandings of the world. They just dream what they see. Let's continue with the mythological creatures. I choose Chimera and Pegasus, which are the most vivid one, in my perspective. Chimera composed of the parts of more than one animal. It is usually depicted as a lion with head of goat arising from its back and a tail with a snake's head. The term chimera has come to describe any mythological or fictional being with parts taken from different animals, as you see in the pictures. And when we observe the appearances of the Pegasus, we see that it is a type of white horse with wings. Early people depicted mythological creatures by using the physical features of animals. That means that dream worlds of the people are formed by earthly things. They restrict the ability of storytelling with the tangible objects. When we look at the myths, the love stories show that ancient people portrayed gods by using humanized features. Not only physical features, but also their emotions are the same. They not only describe God with their physical features, but also they give them some earthly desires like jealous, passion, love. For example, in the story of Europa, there was a maiden whose name is Europa, and she had a surpassing beauty. At the first sight of Europa, Zeus was charmed by her striking beauty and grace. Not being one to ignore his desires, he immediately comes up with a cunning plan. In order to avoid the anger of his jealous wife Hera and to get Europa, Zeus turned into in a white bull. When the young maiden was gathering flowers, she saw the bull and was fascinated by its handsome face and gentle behavior and got onto his head. Zeus took that opportunity to abduct Europa and swam to the islands of Crete. There, he revealed his true identity and impregnated her. Europa gave birth to Minos, who became king of Crete. As we observe that, they make them exactly like human beings. People can be jealous, Hera too. Humankind can be passionate, Zeus too. So we can say that they give humanitarian feelings to their gods. To sum up, firstly, we said that storytelling used to explain unknown and mysterious events. Thanks to stories, people pass their culture from generation to generation. Secondly, we define that the Greeks made their gods in their own image. During the ancient period, the idea of embodying was common. As Saint Paul said, the invisible must be understood by the visible. In the ancient Greeks, people were preoccupied with the visible. They were finding satisfaction of their desires in what was actually around them. But with the technique of concretization, representation of reality became limited and the subjects of the stories could not go beyond the earthly things. Thank you, listening.
I thank Mr. Darius and Ms. Diler for this interesting presentation. I think we can keep the questions to the last, and I will continue with Taha İnan. Taha İnan is also coming from Kocaeli University, and he is greatly interested by mythology and mythos because he had taken some courses on mythology, which urged him to present a paper here. He is also interested in English Renaissance and Victorian period. His paper is entitled Punishment Myths as Conduct Narratives of Ancient Greek Oral Tradition.
Thank you for representing me. Hello everyone. Today, as mentioned before, I'll be presenting Punishment Myths as Conduct Narratives of Ancient Greek Oral Tradition. Can we change? Before we continue on with the presentation, I'd like to share a guideline in order to make it more easier to follow and comprehend. So first of all, The presentation will be divided into four divisions. The first division will be an introduction of myth-making in ancient Greece, ancient Greek society. And second, I'll give a full detailed explanation of conduct narratives and the genre by giving two examples in order to make it easier to understand. And then the following division, I'll be giving a detailed explanation about punishment myths as conduct narratives and their association. And at last, I'll be telling four short stories centered around four sinner characters, and we'll be analyzing how the elements that which make them conduct narratives. Can we change? Ancient Greek myths were products of oral storytelling tradition, and they were produced for various reasons. First of all, the ancient Greeks told myths in order to explain the creation of the world, nature, and human beings. Second, myths also they functioned as an explanation for natural events such as storms, earthquakes, and the changing cycle of seasons. They were also a way of depicting religious practices and worshipping rituals, and they also functioned as entertaining stories, which is why we can consider them as early literature. Last but not least, through myths, storytellers aim to advise people the ethical ways and behavior. In other words, some myths, specifically the punishment myths, intend to give a didactic lesson to the people in order to keep them stable. Conduct narratives, they can be both either fictional or non-fictional. Fictional as pamphlets and tracts, which are more directly, they give the aim more directly, and there can be non-fictional as noble of manners, conduct nobles, which punishment myths are categorized in the second category as products of oral literature. Can we change? Before I continue with conduct narratives, I would like to give a quotation. Let's see. I kind of have a memorization problem. In the quotation below, as you can see, it has been stated by Harbert F. Tucker in A Companion to Victorian Literature and Culture that Ellis and like-minded thinkers, including the writers of Acutius Conduct and Child-Rearing Manuals, during the 1840s, assumed that a woman's goal in life was marriage and her vocation to bear and raise children. This is in the Victorian period. As you know, women, they were disciplined to follow some behaviors which were convenient in that day. And here you can see in the picture, there's a woman and she devotes herself to her children, and supposedly she's not working. She'll be doing her domestic issues. She'll be fulfilling her domestic responsibilities. This is my first example of conduct narratives from the early 18th and 19th centuries. Can we change? So the most dominant writer in the Victorian period is Sarah Stickney Ellis. She was a bestseller Victorian author who published numerous conduct books. Conduct books are a genre in the Victorian period. They aim to tell people the ethical ways of behavior. And these are some works of Ellis's works. As you can see, they evoke conductive elements in, just on the titles. Like, for example, The Wives of England. We can understand that they were read by women to acknowledge their responsibilities as wives. And then there's the women of England, the mothers of England, the daughters of England. So specifically, they taught the code of conduct for the Victorian woman. They were aimed and addressed for the Victorian woman. Can we carry on, please? This is one of her books, and as you can see, the title, The Woman of England, Their Social Duties and Domestic Habits. So we can understand that The book emphasizes women's social duties and domestic habits. We can carry on. That was my first example. And my second example will be from the early 19th centuries. And this is a book from the children's literature of that era. Herein, actually, the book was given to children to teach them the correct behaviors. You know, children, they can be mischievous and they can have like bad habits. And for example, they can steal, they will lie because they're afraid of their parents or such things. Or you know that children, they don't have a full conscience. So in order to make them practice religion, they were also emphasized from books such as The Children's First Tales by William Carus Wilson. I would like to point out a small region. It's actually, I quoted it on the bottom, but in the story it's here. Oh, what a sad thing it is to steal. So we can understand that the misbehavior here is actually the child's stealing. And then it carries on, oh, what a sad thing it is to steal. Would you like to be sent from all your kind friends and nice home? So it's actually emphasizing and treating kids not to steal. And if you steal, you will be taken away. So children were conducted to not steal and behave themselves. We can carry on. Now I will be carrying on with punishment myths. But before, I would like to read something from my paper. Punishment myths are orally narrated mythical stories about mortals who transgress norms, challenge, deny, or offend the Greek gods, and eventually face severe penalties because of their misconduct. So we can understand from here that the punishment myths, just as the examples before, they conducted people in ancient Greece to follow certain rules. So I'll be giving a quotation again about punishment myths. Monica Chirino offers a thorough definition of punishment myths. Quote, "The punishment myth pattern is a universal and obscure story motif in Greek mythology that serves the function of a narrative warning to human beings about the necessity of correct behavior." So we can see that the people, the ancient Greek people, from the quotation with regards, we can see that the ancient Greeks used punishment myths in order to show the correct ways of behavior, the behaviors which are which are convenient. We can carry on. Now, punishment myths, they actually evaluate, they develop in three stages. Herein, as I have, as you see in the slide, the first stage is hubris, second is 80, and then there's nemesis. So the first, actually, hubris is the sin itself. For example, we know from the religions in our days today that there's certain rules to follow, and if you don't follow those rules, you'll be punished at the end. So this is a basically same thing. It's in the same theme. So the first stage, hubris, as you can see, committing an undesirable act which offends the gods. So when you offend the gods, it's known as an inconvenient way to act. And then there's the second stage, 80. The sinners continue the misconduct stubbornly. So they think themselves right. They think their whatever their action is, they think it's not inconvenient yet. So they're unconscious and they're blindfolded to carry on their acts. And then there's the third stage, which is the final stage and consists of the punishment itself. The severe penalty of going beyond the pale. So herein we can understand that actually the first stage and the third stage are the stages which we'll be working on. The second stage is a normal stage, so I won't be emphasizing anything about it. I'd also like to add that the penalty is sentenced by Zeus, the king of the gods. I think most of us know him. And then it takes place at the realm of Hades named the Pit of Tartarus. So we can understand that the Pit of Tartarus is, as we know today, hell. And they're punished at that particular place. Can we carry on? This is the statue of Zeus at Olympia. Just so we can understand his kingship better, I wanted to share it with you. As you can see, he's on a throne, and he looks muscled and really authoritative. Can we carry on? And this is Hades. Okay. Okay.
Okay.
And now I will be, can you hear me? Okay. I'll be, and this is Hades. As you can see, he looks like a dark character in the pit of Tartarus. And behind him is his pet, Cerberus, a three-headed dog. Can we continue? And now is the now we'll be continuing with the last division, the fourth division, the punishment myth itself. And I'll be narrating the stories. As I said, I have a memory problem, but I'll try to refer from my paper and go back and forth. It's not what you think, really. It's something else. It's a punishment myth, and at the end, we will see what's the punishment. So, King Sisyphus is actually regarded as the most talented, smart, cunning sinner in ancient Greek mythology. He's known for his trickery, his smartness, and his venture starts off with exposing Zeus's sexual thrills openly to everyone. So when you open up an embarrassment of someone else, what happens? You get the person on the other side really, really mad. And this guy's a god, so you better not mess with him. Anyways, Zeus gets really mad, and then he addresses his helper, or let me say, a divine figure named Death, as the word speaks for itself. He takes away the souls of people that are addressed to him. And then, now Death is, he has a duty to go and take away Sisyphus' life in order to end the situation, his foolishness. When Death goes into the presence of the king Sisyphus, he's a smart king, so he tricks Death and he chains him down. And when Zeus realizes this, the situation, he gets really, really pissed off. So now he needs to send somebody that's even stronger to fulfill the duty. So he addresses his son Hermes, which is also a trickster god. He's really tricky. He's known for his trickstery. He addresses his son to release Death, and then sent Sisyphus to the pit of Tartarus. So, Hermes goes and he goes to the presence of Sisyphus. He unleashes Death, and he makes sure that Sisyphus is sent to hell, the pit of Tartarus. But the cunning king, he's really smart. So he thinks of a plan. How can I get rid? How can I get out of the pit of Tartarus and continue my earthly life? So he talks to his wife and he instructs her not to bury her corpse and arrange a funeral. So what happens when your wife doesn't arrange a funeral for you? You look like obliged. You look like you're neglected. And this actually went after that. Sisyphus tells his wife to not bury him or arrange a ceremony. Now, Sisyphus is in the pit of Tartarus, and as I have mentioned before, Hades is the person that's responsible of the pit of Tartarus. So Hades realizes that Sisyphus' wife is neglecting Sisyphus. It's kind of confusing, I know, or maybe not. And Hades dismisses the king back to Earth to punish his wife. He says, go and punish your wife, because, yeah, she's misbehaved herself and she hasn't fulfilled her duty as a wife to you. So once again, King Sisyphus, he goes back to Earth and he tricks the gods. He carries on his life with his wife, and they live a happy life together, and eventually they grow old, and the king dies. Okay, when you die, again, you will be sentenced either to go to hell or heaven, as we know. But Sisyphus, he doesn't have a good... penalty. So they sentenced him. I'll come to that 1 minute. Let me check from here if I missed anything. Okay, the punishment. The punishment is actually this. Sisyphus is condemned to roll a boulder up a mountain for the rest of forever. And when he gets to the top, he rolls back down and he does it consecutively over and over again, and he gets really, really tired and annoyed. And the thing on his back is a winged demon. He's punishing him, maybe hammering him. And this is the punishment myth of Sisyphus. Can we continue? And here's another depiction. You know, there's various versions of punishments in Greek mythology, because there isn't an exact story. In here, he's not actually rolling the boulder. He has it on his back, and he's carrying it up to the top of the mountain. And also, I'd like to add that it not only represents conduct narratives as punishment myths as conduct narratives, but it also inspires philosophy, which I'll be reading from here. The circulation of Sisyphus' punishment not only explains conduct narratives in ancient Greek mythology, but it also evokes the absurdity of life and inspires the existential philosophy in the 20th century. This is because life itself actually consists nothing but the hustle and bustle of daily life, which is implied with the image of a mortal senselessly rolling a boulder up and down a mountain consecutively over and over again. So actually it says that, yeah, we do the same things every day. We're part of the system and we're condemned to do this. So it actually, it criticizes the human nature and it inspires philosophy. Before I continue, I would like to emphasize this. 1 minute. So the hubris, the sin of Sisyphus is cheating and tricking the gods. So we can understand that the punishment myth of Sisyphus actually emphasized the ancient Greeks not to cheat and not to trick, especially a god. And I will be carrying on with the punishment myth of Tantalus. King Tantalus is the son of Zeus. He's actually, the punishment myth is based on idiocy. He's an idiot guy, really. So we can see that before, we have explained about a cunning guy, and in the Greeks, we also have idiots. It's based on, actually, his curiosity. So he sits one day and he's thinking, he's thinking about the omniscience of the gods. If they can tell the future, if they can know something that hasn't been told to them. That's the meaning of omniscience. So he comes up with a plan. He says that, okay, let me test the gods, put them to a test, invite them over to my house, palace, he's a king. Invite them over to my palace and give them a feast. In order to put them to a test, he sacrifices his own son. He slaughters his son Pelop, and he serves his son as a main dish at the feast, at the dinner. And he doesn't say anything about what it is, what the meat is. So the gods, as you can see here, are around a table. It's not really net, actually. But we can see that here a main dish is served and there's gods around. This is Zeus. So the dish is served, they open the plates, and they see meat. All the gods, they realize what it is, except Demeter, who was in a grief, she was unconscious. And from here, we can understand that Tantalus, for testing the gods, for not relying on them, he is punished. Can we continue? at the pit of Tartarus. He is surrounded by delicious food and everything, but he's not allowed to reach them. And as you can see here, he's trying to reach for a fruit, an apple maybe, but he can't really take it and eat it. So he's starved forever. And from here we can understand that for the hubris, for the sin of, for the hubris of offending, tricking, trying to trick and cheat on the gods, he was forever starved and provoked with the surroundings of delicious food and sprinkling water at the deep pit of Tartarus. So people in ancient Greeks were emphasized not to trick, not to offend anybody, especially a god. We can continue on. This is the third punishment myth. It's a myth based on Asclepius. Asclepius is actually a divine figure. He's the son of the god of medicine, Apollo. And like his father, he himself is also a physician. Actually, the punishment myth is really short, but it's really important because it's based on living forever, not thinking about death or what do they call it? Like he's never gonna die. He's an immortal. It's based on immortality, let me say. So Asclepius, like his father, he's a physician. And he's at the pinnacle of his healing. He's healing people. That he can even revive the dead people. So he can resurrect people. And as it goes on, the Greek society, the Greek people, they find out that somebody can revive their beloveds from the grave. So people start begging him and revive their beloveds. And Asclepius, he revives them, he resurrects the ancient Greeks. But the problem is that he was interfering with death and life. So as we know, there is like a balance. People die, new people get born, and it continues on like this. So what happens is the flow of souls to hell, the pit of Tartarus, starts decreasing. And humans in the world, they start increasing and increasing, and hates the person that's the divine figure that's responsible of the pit of Tartarus. He realizes that his realm is empty. So he gets really disturbed, and he complains to Zeus, the king of the gods, about Asclepius's miscue. And Zeus finds him righteous, and he sentences Asclepius to die, to death. But now, as you know, he can revive everybody, but now he can't even revive himself, so he's punished. I will be referring to, again, so we can understand, for the hubris of interfering with the balance between life and death, Asclepius was punished with death himself, incapable of resurrecting himself. So it was emphasized that to the Greek people that they will die eventually, and they shouldn't seek to live forever. We can continue on. This is my favorite punishment myth, the punishment myth of Arachne. Actually, for this one, I want to read from the paper because it's kind of long and it's also, it could be confused. Okay, I'll take a little rest here. So, myths that are created around the theme of challenging a god to a contest abound in ancient Greek mythology. The following myth is also based upon this type of thing, challenging a god. It begins with Arachne's arrogance with the skillful art in embroidering tapestry. As you can see from the picture, here is Arachne. I'll be mentioning about the other figure. She's waving tapestry. She was praised throughout the entire Greece, but even though she was greatly talented, it was obviously known that she was only the second best after the goddess Athena. One day, Arachne, who believed herself better, had enough of Athena's unfair dominance and claimed that if a contest was to be held, she would prevail the goddess. Athena, in disguise as an old woman, visited Arachne to warn her for acting foolish in challenging the goddess, but the warning was useless. Arachne's confidence in herself had already exceeded the stage of hubris into aid. She was blindfolded into madness. Therefore, a ceremony was arranged, the crowd gathered, and the competitors started waving. As you can see from the slide, there's Athena on the left, and there's Arachne on the right, and they're contesting each other. They're waving tapestry and embroidery, and we will see what will happen at the end. After hours, two masterpieces came into view. Arachne had depicted the embarrassing acts of gods, whereas Athena pictured the destiny of those who go too far beyond the pale, who exceed their own boundaries. Although Arachne was victorious, Athena's throne and tapestry was threatened. So the goddess ripped apart the insulting masterwork into pieces. Arachne, with extreme grief, couldn't bear the iniquity and killed herself, but the goddess, with compassion, turned the dead body into a spider. I'll explain again. So they're contesting each other. Arachne claimed that she's better than the goddess Athena, and they're waving as in the slide. And then we'll come to the result. Can we change, please? Here is Athena, and yeah, okay. Arachne won, but you know Athena is the goddess, so you don't have to mess with her, even if you're better than her. So, and you can see Athena, and this is Arachne here. She's transforming into, she's being transformed into a spider. As you know, spiders they also have. A talent of waving. They have what do they call it? Webs. Yes. Sorry, I'm kind of excited. So they have webs. So she goes on forever, continuing her tapestry in webbing. So we can understand from here, even though Arachne could at least carry on her mastery by netting, even though she attempted the hubris of contesting and defying a god. So people were emphasized not to contest and defy a god or anybody, any other authority that's above them. Can we carry on? Okay, the last punishment myth is the myth of Ixion. Ixion was also a king, but he had a misconduct. He did something that was bad. He killed his father-in-law. So now he needs to be purified. And Zeus invites him over to Mount Olympus to purify him, and he accepts. So he goes over to Mount Olympus, and while he got there, the arrangements were still continuing on. So he wandered around. Whereas at that part, he sees the wife of Zeus, Hera. So when he sees Hera, he kind of loses himself. He's also a lusty king. So he offends her, sexually offends her. So Hera gets really annoyed of this action, of this conduct, and complains to her wife, her husband, Zeus. Zeus at first doesn't believe her, but then he wants to put his guest into a plan. He wants to put Ixion into a plan. So he creates another Hera from clouds, and he sends the cloud into Ixion's presence. So when Ixion sees Hera, he sexually offends her. He wants to obtain her. This time, since the Hera isn't the real Hera, it's the Hera which was made out of clouds, accepts Ixion's sexual, okay? So then Zeus realizes that his guest was he did an action which was inconvenient. So because of the hubris of offending a goddess, especially sexually offending a goddess, he was chained around a wheel, as you can see, a wheel with fire, and to be sent around in pit of Tartarus forever. And you can see that he's here, he's tied with snakes, and over here. So, in conclusion, what we have to see. Amla Aksha, the myths explained above and many other punishment myths were preached in the ancient Greece as conduct narratives. In this way, the Greek society learned the ethical ways of behavior, and with the fear of being punished, they disciplined themselves to never exceed their self-boundaries. Thank you for listening.
Taha İnan for vast, enlarged study about mythology. And now we have a beginner items presentation. First of all, I would like to introduce her. She's a fourth year student at Hacettepe University, English Language and Literature Department. And she is interested in taking part in the following conferences. IAPESGW Regional Symposium, International Gender Issues and Support, Tarihi Değiştiren Toplumu Dönüştüren Kadınlar, Türk Dili Kültürü ve Tarihi, British and Turkish Literary and Cultural Interactions. Also, she works as an editor in Edebiyat Student Journal of English Language and Literature at Hacettepe University. She also writes short stories. The paper she is going to present is entitled From the Creator of the Universe to the Filmmaker. The floor is yours.
Dear scholars, and my dear friends, and dear participants, I would like to welcome you to my presentation in which I will analyze how a biblical story is adapted to the postmodern narrative. As it is widely known, the Christian Bible has two sections. The first one is Old Testament, and the second one is New Testament. Old Testament begins with the chapter Genesis, in which the narrative describes how God created the world and chain of beings. This is the quotation from the flood story, or we can call it also the Noah's Ark story, which is included in Genesis part. Quote, the Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground. For I regret that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord, unquote. I would like to show some representations of Noah's Ark. This is the painting one. This is the cartoon version, especially for children. And this is my version. It is a present for one of my Christian friends. And Noah's Ark story is told from, as you know, generation to generation, according to religion it bears. This presentation deals with the one which belongs to Genesis flood narrative from Bible. To the Christian faith, it is believed that God wants to destroy everything by flooding the earth because of humans' misdeeds, and he wants to recreate it by using the Noah's Ark. Also, according to Christian believers, it is a dignifying and glorifying story, because the Bible itself is seen as the Holy Scripture, which is the medium of communication between God and people. However, this had been a serious story dealing with God in a serious manner until it was adapted to postmodern metafiction. Jeanette Winterson's Boating for Beginners is an example of postmodern metafiction concerning with Noah's Ark story. This presentation aims to show how the biblical Noah's Ark story is adapted to the Jeanette Winterson's postmodern fiction Boating for Beginners in a parodic manner through the use of some postmodern elements, such as intertextuality, parody, decentralization, and artificiality. To clarify what postmodern metafiction is, we had better start with the term postmodernism. Postmodernism is a portmanteau word, which means a vague and contradictory term containing different ideas. The prefix post suggests that any postmodernism inextricably bound up with modernism, either as a replacement of modernism or as chronologically after modernism. In other words, we can say that from this quotation, postmodernism either the continuation of modernism or it is supersedent replacement for modernism by rejecting it. And let's look at metafiction. According to Wolff, metafiction is a term given to fictional writing, which self-consciously and systematically draws attention to its status as an artifact in order to pose questions about the relationship between fiction and reality. So, in metafiction, there is a big emphasis on artificiality. We, as readers, are drawn attention to what the creation or the text is not real. I would like to draw your attention to the two quotations from the book which show how the flood Noah story is integrated to the postmodern metafiction. The first quotation, quote, "All this was happening a long time ago, before the flood. The big flood starring God and Noah and the cast of thousands who never survived to collect their royalty checks. Of course you know the story, because you read it in the Bible and other popular textbooks. But there is so much more between the lines. It is a blockbuster full of infamy, perfidy, and frozen food, and in just a few hours, when you read it, this book, your life will seem rich and full," unquote. This quotation communicates with the Bible, as the book itself does. The text opens with intertextual reference. It brings forward Noah's Ark story in the Bible, but in a very humorous and witty sense. In this sense, Tim Wood describes intertextuality as the relationship texts have with other texts or discourses, whether on a conscious or unconscious level. And also, in this quotation, we hear the voice of the author openly. She informs us that she will tell us an artificial story made up by her. She emphasizes that this novel is just metafiction, not a real story. She draws attention on its artifice. And the other quotation is taken from book, quote, "Stunned by the success of their literary collaboration, Noah and God had decided to dramatize the first two books, bringing in bunny mix to add legitimate spice and romantic interest. Ham and Shem were to play different aspects of Yahweh, because everyone agreed that God is a multifaceted and complex character who shouldn't be restricted by a single actor." We understand that from this quotation, Lord and Noah collaborated before, and they wrote a Genesis or How I Did It, which tells the history of the world. And as a result of this literary collaboration, Noah became very rich. So he wants to use God in filmmaking to become richer. Also, there is a reference to, as you see, Ham and Shem. They are the sons of Noah. Also, Noah wants them to play in the film. What is the importance of this quotation from the postmodern perspective? Let's look at it. This quotation shows examples of fabulation and parody, like the novel itself. Fabulation, quote, "meant fiction that insists on its unreality, that openly proclaims its artifice," unquote. It is making everything seem like a fairy tale. Parody is, quote, "a mode of imitation of past conventions in a subversive way," unquote. God, Noah, Ham, Shem, and other biblical figures are shown as funny and comic in a deep storyline. Also, there is a decentering of the subject, God. It means the what is the centering of the subject? It is related to postmodernism. It means, quote, an identity, consciousness, or ego which is deferred, displaced, fragmented, or marginalized within a situation, unquote. Winterson takes this serious biblical story and turns into a funny and unserious story. She is actually making a parody of the institutional religion by showing God and biblical figures as filmmakers. God is turned into a filmmaker from the creator of the universe, and his dignity is destroyed, collapsed, vanished. There is no God of Victorian times anymore in postmodernism, actually. There is no omnipotent, omniscient God anymore. In conclusion, in this presentation, I try to show how biblical story is made use of in the postmodern narrative by using the postmodern narrative techniques such as intertextuality, parody, decentralization, and artificiality. Thank you for all speaking.
I thank you very much for your clear timing and clear and great clear-cut points, by the way, about postmodernism and Janet Winterson. Now, time for questions. I suppose there will be some interesting questions that you are going to ask, because we started from a kind of old Greece mythology and come to the postmodernism in which we live now. No questions. Commentary? If you don't, I have some questions to our presenters. First of all, I'm going to ask the two first presenters today. They focused on mostly the imagination. I'm going to look at my notes. And they try to explain the image of the God, which is fulfilled with the body of the human. And this is really interesting, but the body becomes a kind of man body, male body. Do you have any idea about the gender relations? How do you relate it with the Greek mythology, and how body represents male instead of female? Maybe you can think about it, and I can ask the other questions. While you are thinking, I can read the other questions. And the other one is for Taha Inan, and it was a really extensive presentation. I will focus on gender relations once again, because the conduct books are most of the time used as a kind of didactic things to implore the visions of reality. They created a kind of reality which people cannot deny, and this reality is really harsh on women, and we see Sarah Stickney Ellis as a kind of example. And even though we have a kind of man punishment in Greek mythology, how did it change in Victorian literature? Why there is a change from male to female, man to women in conduct narratives? You can take your friend, can talk now, actually. Because he is ready from the very beginning, I think. Start.
Actually, we focus on the imagination. We don't think about the gender relationship male or female. But maybe I just can guess, because I don't know really why they use male or female. I think they use male because at that time there was a patriarchal society too. And the powerful ones are males, again, then deserves the Lord of the Gods. Actually, the Lord, mm-hmm. The word means power, and power means generally male for ancient Greece, not my
yes,
opinion.
Yes, that's true, we are not offended.
I have silence. They can be female, actually, I think it's about society.
Maybe it can enlarge your vision for the next history.
history that males have always been prominent over women, unfortunately. But in ancient Greek, as we can see, women, we have actually punishment myths that are based on women, but men are more faced. So since men are more prominent in the ancient Greece, so the punishment myths were carried on with men more than women. But as we see in the Victorian period, there's an intellectual idea that's rising from women. So in order to keep pressure on women, they had to conduct books in order to keep the prominent men society above. For example, in like kingship or the courtiery or maybe even writing. So I think that's the reason why we can find contradictory.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions, commentary? Yes, please.
I want to object your saying that the gods were just males. They discussed about Hera, Zeus' wife, and Aphrodite, and other female gods were also presented, and it hasn't changed since. We have less women or female representatives in our governments and congress and everything in life. And in Taha's program, I was going to ask him, he showed us a picture of Zeus being punished. And underneath it was written that it was found in an ancient storehouse in Italy. And I wanted to ask, is he sure about it's being from Greek mythology, but not from Roman mythology? And does it make difference?
Actually, it's I'm not really sure about where it's Rome or Greek. But most likely, it could be Rome, because we don't have many familiar reliefs about Greek mythology, which goes back to the Greeks, the ancient Greeks. So I'm not sure, but most likely it's Rome.
Thank you.
Thank you for your commentary. Yes, please.
Is what Taha? I don't know if this thing is working.
Yeah, it's working. We can hear you.
Okay. So I just want to say, can we consider medieval romances as conduct books as well?
Actually, there's in history we can find various kinds of conduct narratives, because there's always a pressure to keep people stable and to keep them away from being an authoritative figure. So we can find it in the Romance period, we can find it in the Victorian period, we can find it in the Renaissance period. We can, not just for the English literature history, but not just in literature, we can find it in other societies around the world. So since I don't really know what's going on in the Romance period, I know them actually, but I'm not a profession about it, so I can't specifically say something, but most likely there's various conduct narratives in various societies around the world.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you for your commentary and question. And we have one more question.
So my question is for Taha, right?
Sure.
I actually kind of have the same question. Could we, when we're talking about Quran, could we say that Quran is also a conduct narrative?
We can say that. We can also say that for the Bible too. Why? Because in the human beings there's an action to act freely, and we can see this in everybody. Everybody wants to do something which is out of their boundaries, which they can't reach, and most likely when you reach it, the value decreases. So anyways, in the Quran, there's conduct narratives. In the Bible, there's conduct narratives.
most likely in every religion, because religion is actually something that's based on conducting human beings.
Yeah, and one more actually I can just ask on that.
Sure.
You said that we have this tendency to move freely or do things freely.
Yes.
Like, right. Could we talk about the principle of the least effort, I believe, that's coined by one of the psychologists in 1960s or 70s, I don't know. But like, it's basically the idea that we tend to do less than we should, or like, for example, we tend to spend less amount of, or less effort than we should or than we could. So I think that's kind of the same thing with the tendency to move freely.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Actually, the thing is that our intentions, our instincts are based on going beyond, doing something. Because even when we're born, when a child, he or she wonders so much, what is this, what is that, what is it? So because of our curiosity, it gives us an instinction to act freely, go beyond the pale. And did I satisfy your question?
Yes, that's right. And one more, actually. I just continue this conversation. So, for example, based on what I said with the principle of the least effort, when the Quran says work hard or try to be a better member of your society by working hard, that's also conducting art. Is that right?
Actually, it is. So, I don't want to carry on like a preach here, but
sure.
In the Quran it says. It actually emphasizes people to work hard, because in order to achieve something, you have to give a certain effort. And you know, in our instincts, as you said, we want to give the least effort to obtain the most. So in the Quran, it says that you have to you give your efforts as much as you can, and it will take place. You will obtain what you want. It's actually a conduct narrative to establish the Muslims. In a better situation, in better places. So it's a conduct narrative.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jen.
Okay, I think no more questions and commentary, and we will go on further questions and commentary at the coffee break, I suppose. I thank all the presenters here. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your contributions, and also yours. We will be 3 o'clock.